This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories to tell. Each week we visit with veterans from the World War II generation. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. And if you were to go to a service at St. John's Catholic Church in Encinitas, California, and see an elderly gentleman helping out around there, you might never know what he went through in World War II. And I don't know if I should say elderly. You're only 90 years old, Duke O'Donnell. But let's go back to Berwyn, Illinois. You grew up there in the 1920s and 30s. What do you remember about Chicago in those days?
Well, we never got to Chicago very much because we're 10 miles away in a suburb. And you remember the lake when we did go to Chicago, Lake Michigan, very nice and crowded. So mainly, though, we stayed in Berwyn.
Was the Great Depression felt where you were, an only child?
Yeah, I remember had to watch our pennies. A lot of people were out of work. They had people on relief, they called it, and I think they got $18 a month for rent. Yeah, we had to watch everything. When we left the room, we turned the light off, that's for sure.
No different these days in Cardiff by the Sea, California, where you live now. I'm sure you turn the light off when you leave the room now. Do you remember, as a young teenager, having any dreams, ambitions, something you thought you were going to do with your life?
Offhand, I don't know. Probably thought I'd go into business, become some kind of a businessman.
You didn't think you were going to play football for Notre Dame or anything?
At that point, no.
Were you a Notre Dame fan in those Newt Rockne years?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you bet. Mm-hmm. That was a great, they had great teams.
Yeah, and after World War II, you'd end up going to school there. But a lot happened between your teenage years and that point. And in fact, you were still in high school when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember that day, December 7th?
Oh, yeah, Sunday. Yeah, I do. Quite a shock to hear that they had attacked Pearl Harbor and we were at war. And
how did you find out?
Probably listening to the radio. In those days, no TV then, but the radio, we heard it. Yeah, that was a real shocker.
Was there any thought at all in your mind that we're at war now and maybe I'm going to be a part of this at some point?
Yeah, sure was. I thought at that point, yeah, well, I'm probably going to be in it. Because I was, I'd be 16 then, so it looked like it's going to be at least a two-year war left. So, yeah, I thought I'd probably get in it.
And you did volunteer to get in the Army right after you graduated high school?
Well, right before they had the aviation cadet program where you could join as an aviation cadet, and then they let you graduate from high school before they called you up. So I joined there, and then a week after I got out of high school, I found myself in Shepherd Field, Texas, at basic training.
Was that a bit of an awakening? Because you were an only child. You didn't have a big brother to beat you up and toughen you up or anything.
No, they did there. That was tough because it was West Texas in the middle of summer, you know, hot. We'd run into the shower with all our clothes on and run out, and you're dry as a bone in 5 or 10 minutes. Yeah.
Were there ever days where you said, what in the world did I get myself into?
Yeah, about 3 days after I got to Shepherd Field, I made a big mistake here, but too late to do anything about it.
Most veterans who I've talked to who ended up serving in the Army Air Corps, whether they ended up being pilots, navigators, bombardiers, gunners, most of them say, hey, I got in the Air Corps because I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be in the cockpit. I wanted to be in control. But that wasn't your ambition?
Well, I wanted to be an officer. That's why I was a bombardier, and so I was a flight officer, yeah.
And how did you end up being a bombardier? How did that that fork in the road, how did you end up taking that path?
Well, they had what they call the stay-nine testing. You got a number from 1 to 9 as a result of the test you took. And
and what kind of test was that? What kind of questions were you asked?
Oh, all kinds. It was mainly intelligent. No, yeah, all it was not just the only written exam. It was dexterity of your hands, physical as well as mental. And you got a grade from 1 to 9.
So you took that test, and then they said, you want to be a pilot, a navigator, or a bombardier?
Yeah, I said bombardier, so...
And was that your idea, or did someone else put that in your head?
Yeah, well, a priest friend of mine said, we'll try for bombardier. So I did, and it turned out that my stay nine was 6. To be a pilot, you had to have a 9, and navigator, you had to have a 7. But bombardier, you only had to have a 6. So that's the way I got in the officer program.
So you did become a bombardier on a B-17 Flying Fortress. Do you remember the first time you went up in one of those planes and what that felt like?
You mean in a B-17?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was training in Florida. We went to in Tampa, Florida. We had a base there. Drew Field, which is now Tampa International Airport. But so we trained in B-17s there. And yeah, it was, of course, new to me to get into a B-17, so that was nice.
Was that a little intimidating, being on that big of an airplane? Was it exciting? Because not many guys your age before that had a chance to do something like that.
Well, in the bombardier school, we trained in a twin-engine plane called a Kansan. It was a bombardier trainer. So the B-17 was a lot like it, only a lot bigger, you know.
And you had either the best seat on the plane or the worst seat on the plane, depending on your perspective, I guess, right?
Well, it sure you sure could see things from that. I tell you, that was one time they had going over... We were bombing the bridge over Mannheim, Dusseldorf, Germany, from Mannheim to Dusseldorf, over the Rhine River. And before a mission, we had always went to a briefing. Briefing officer would tell us whatever they knew about the target and the defenses. And he said, there are 350 flak guns down there. So we went on the mission, and they had three ways of firing at you. They had they fired directly at the plane, or they had what was tracking flak, which is they'd shoot ahead of the plane, and on the bomb run you can't deviate from course. So if you see flak ahead, you have to fly right into it. There's nothing else you can do. Or they had box flak, what they call it. They put everything they had up in the air into one place at one time, and if you're caught in there, you're done for. So we're going along this one mission, and up ahead goes up like 350 artillery shells going off at the same place in the sky at the same time. What a sight I'll never forget. I usually was about scared as I could be, but I that time I was just awestruck.
Well, and there's awestruck, and then there's actually struck in the face, and we're going to talk about that. But before that, explain to everyone. Some people know, and if they've listened to this show for a long time, I'm sure they know. But explain to everybody who doesn't know where the bombardier sits on a B-17.
Yeah, it sits right in the front. So, and you have plexiglass. The nose is a good part plexiglass. So you can see. That's the purpose of it. You got a wonderful view. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't like to see what you see, but it's a wonderful view.
Yeah, so the pilots are above and behind you. So if there is flak or there's an enemy aircraft, you're going to be the first one who sees it, and the one who's in between that enemy and the rest of your crew, right?
If they're coming from the front, right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would come from all angles, certainly. And what about your crew? Did you have your crew together before you headed overseas?
Oh, yes. We all trained together in Tampa, Florida, and then went over together to England on the Ile de France, a French luxury liner. 9,000 of us on board. And we got 2 meals a day, 12 hours apart. So they serve meals continuously, round the clock. So I think we ate like at 3 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon, something like that. So and we took 9 days to get from New Jersey to Scotland, because we went down along the coast of Africa to avoid the submarines. So.
Were you starting to get a little antsy or nervous? Were you concerned about what may be in front of you? I mean, you're only 19 years old.
Well, I knew it's going to be dangerous work, all right. Mm-hmm. And then it was dangerous work.
There's a Purple Heart license plate on your Mercury to prove it. Your base was Molesworth, England. Tell us where that was and what you found there when you got there.
Well, Molesworth was about 70 miles north of London in Huntingdonshire. They had a base there. We had 4 squadrons in our group called 303rd Bomb Group. We put up 39 planes on a mission, a normal mission. Unless it was something real big, then we'd put up maybe as many as we could. To call it maximum effort, then we put every plane that would fly up. But there were four of the four squadrons in the group. Three would normally fly, and one would stay down, stand down, as we called it, resting. So we did it there.
You remember your first mission?
Yeah, it was to Bulle, Germany, along the Rhine River, and the Battle of the Bulge had just started. So we were trying to bomb the railroad yards of different towns leading up to the Battle of the Bulge, so the Germans couldn't get reinforcements up.
And you had a pretty important job as the bombardier. So as you approach the target, at what point do you take over control of the airplane?
At the beginning of the bomb run, usually about, as I recall, like 35 miles from the target. And then you'd fly the plane with the bomb sight. It was hooked up to the automatic pilots.
And you mentioned the bomb sight. What could you see through that bomb sight? What were the capabilities of that sight?
Yeah, you could, and you had crosshairs. I mean, you had, you know, you had synchronized on the target.
And some pretty good magnification?
It wasn't awful of a magnification, but you could see the target, you know, see the ground.
And you had practice back in the States, I'm sure, whether you're dropping bombs or sacks of flour or something, in terms of when you drop it, because you're moving at a pretty high rate of speed, so you have to time it just right, huh?
Well, the bomb sight takes care of all that. It's all so automatic, yeah. It's amazing. It was an amazing device for its time.
It gives you a signal when you're in a spot where you can flip the switch and drop the bombs.
No, they go out automatically. It would automatically go out, yeah.
So that was your first mission, and you guys didn't encounter any enemy aircraft or anything?
No enemy aircraft. FLAC. We always had FLAC.
And how did you feel about that? So this is your first experience with anti-aircraft fire. How close was it, and how'd it make you feel when you saw it?
On this particular mission, there wasn't too much FLAC, but it's a scary business, even though. Well, we had, I think, well, every mission we had at least one or two holes, or maybe three or four in the ship, you know. But so you can see it going off, and I mean, it's a scary business.
And how would you describe the camaraderie among your crew? Were you guys pretty close together?
Yeah, we sure were. Yeah, we certainly were. We were all under the same gun, you might say. And we certainly would help each other doing whatever we could.
And one of the reasons I was really excited to catch up with you today is because I've had your name on my list for years, because your pilot, Bill McLeod, was one of the first veterans I interviewed 10 years ago, and he told me a story about you, which we're going to get from your perspective. But I get the feeling that you thought pretty highly of him. You had a lot of trust in him as your pilot.
Sure did. He was a very good pilot, and I was certainly happy about that, because I was glad we had a good win. Two good pilots. Co-pilot Dick Elkins, very good too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know your whole crew felt that way about you, and we're going to provide a little proof of that when we come back. A photo of that crew is up at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Duke O'Donnell of Cardiff by the Sea, California, is my guest today. Maybe you're wondering how a boy named Robert came up with the nickname Duke. Well, it was nicknamed by association in his youth. One of his buddies went by the Baron, so naturally he needed a prestigious title too, and he's been Duke ever since. When we come back, we'll hear about Duke's closest call as he remembers it, and also how his pilot recalled it on this very program many years ago. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.